Hello, and thanks for tuning in to the Three Donkeys podcast. This is just a quick technical note to let you know that the next few podcasts are not going to have the best audio quality in the world. It turns out there was an issue unbeknownst to us involving the microphones that left the raw footage, let's call it, less than perfect. So we decided to put the shows up anyway, and we hope that you can forgive us and that you can turn up the volume and hopefully make it work. So, again, we apologize, and here's the show.
Hello, and welcome to the Games with Garfield podcast. My name is Tyler Bielman. I am here, as always, with the intrepid Scaff Elias.
Hello.
And the Honorable Dr. Richard Garfield.
Hi.
And we are joined this week by a very special guest. You know, we have been trying some different formats for the show. We did a single game show last, if you remember.
Scrabble.
We did a Scrabble show. We've done different topics. So we're trying something new today. And we have with us a legendary tabletop game designer in his own right, Mr. James Ernest.
Hello.
Welcome.
How are you?
We're doing well. So, James, tell us about... So, for those who don't know, most people know the Cheap Ass Games brand, yes?
Yeah.
Kill Dr. Lucky,
yep.
Being probably the most recognized Cheap Ass game?
Yeah, Kill Dr. Lucky was the first one we did, and we spent a lot of time pushing it because it was the flagship for 10 years. And now you can get it in a color edition. So yeah, it's a very well known game.
Wow, you started the plugs early. That's fantastic. Who's producing the color version?
Well, that's available from Paizo at paizo.com. That's spelled P-A-I-Z-O.
Excellent. And so let's talk about when you first got into game design. Because actually, I happen to know that you had a career before game design that's pretty interesting as well.
You promised not to talk about that. So I got into game design when I met Richard. Actually, around about that time.
And when was that? You remember?
Do you remember when we met?
I do. It was 93, wasn't it?
Probably, yeah. That's when you guys were
very first year.
Selling shares in Wizards before Magic came out.
But what did you do before that? Come on.
You were Chippendale, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't want to. I was in the Thunder Down Under. I worked at Luxor.
And good job on getting rid of your Australian accent.
Yeah, well, you know, I got rid of all my muscles too. It was a big career change for me. I don't think you are.
Why did you just don't?
To be a professional juggler.
A professional juggler?
Yeah, and any professional you have to say professional in front of it is embarrassment. Nobody says they're a professional lawyer.
Yeah,
so I am a professional doctor.
As a professional juggler.
Also a jugger. We can talk about that too.
What did you charge? What were your rates?
Do you have a bar mitzvah? Actually, so my wife worked at Wizards. And that was when I encountered the $100 threshold. There's a point of wealth and income when driving across town for a kid's birthday party for $100 no longer sounds like a good idea, and that's kind of when I stopped.
And so you come into Wizards, and were you hired right in as a game designer?
Far from it. No, I did game design around that time, and one of the first big design works that I did was a trading card game proposal for Wizards after Magic came out.
What game was that?
I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about it. No, it was called Hero. It was a superhero card game.
Okay, very good. So you come into Wizards. Did you and Richard work together on any projects? Do you remember, guys?
Anything? I don't know. We played some games. We talked about games. I don't know if we actually worked together.
Most of the work that I did with Richard and Scaff was on Magic itself. I wrote the rules a few times. Not the first time, unfortunately, but several times. Subsequent to that. Well, and I also edited the MTGL digest. There was a mailing list, and I cut it down to 10% of the noise.
So you took all the signal
out? I took 100% of the noise. I took 100% of the noise and cut it down to the 10% of the noise that was the most worth reading.
And so, so Scaff, you were around at this time, too?
I was around.
And did you guys do any work together? Do you remember?
I don't think we ever worked on a project together.
So how long were you at Wizards?
About a year.
So not very long.
Not very long.
And so you leave Wizards, presumably under horrible circumstances.
There was a firestorm of meteors, and my desk was hit. And rather than get me a new desk, they just told me I was fired.
Right.
But you after that, you worked on contract basis for Wizards, right?
Before, during, and after. I mean, I did a lot of crazy stuff, including I painted a magic card for Wizards. And
so alternate reality, or?
Reality Twist.
Reality Twist, that's
it. Yeah. In the Ice Age expansion, available nowhere near you.
I've never done a card. I took an animation class last year, though, and threatened to make a card for them. They said they'd be interested. So maybe I'll join your rank of artist.
I think you could probably get in.
So you leave Wizards. Do you immediately start cheap-ass games?
Almost. I did the Xenophile trading card game for Phil Folio.
I'm not sure we're allowed to talk about
that. Describe that a little bit.
I'm not sure we're allowed to talk about that game.
Well, it's you play a card, and you turn it around, and you pop it. It's cool. Oh, you mean the story?
I just...
So,
people might like to know.
When I was at Wizards...
That's what Google's for.
That's right.
When I was at Wizards...
Just turn your content filter off.
Wait, right. And when you Google Xenophile... How many X's would
three
you
Three X's.
Okay, now that we've described Xenophile, we can move on to...
Well, so while I was at Wizards, I was inventing games, and I had a whole bunch that I wanted to publish, and it's very hard to sell a game to a game company if you haven't published anything before. So I, with the 10 or 12 games that I had in my pocket, I started Cheap-Ass Games as a way to just get them into print and learn a little bit more about that business. That was in 96.
And so was Kill Dr. Lucky the first game?
Yeah. There was about a half dozen that were ready to go, and we picked Dr. Lucky as the best of that bunch, and that's why it was the first launch. And so ever since then, it's continued to be the best product in the line, and after 10 years of making worse products, I finally stopped.
Well, we'll get to why you stopped more towards the end. Let's talk a little bit about the meat of it, though. So just fire off some of the more popular titles.
Kill Dr. Lucky.
Pass the Brain.
That's it. Oh, there you go. That's a good one. Give Me the Brain. Button Men. Diceland. Deadwood. Brawl.
Falling.
Fight City. Captain Park's Imaginary Polar Expedition.
So Cheap Ass was a prolific line. How many games did Cheap Ass put out?
Depending on how you count, it was about 100.
I usually count in Latin.
Yeah. But 50 of those are two little collections of 25 games, so, you know, maybe 50 different games.
Right. And Cheap Ass as a brand had a pretty interesting philosophy. Can you speak about that?
Well, the basic idea was that our games didn't come with the spare parts that were generic. So if you need dice or play money or counters, you have to steal them from another game or buy them once. And that's how our games were cheap.
Right. And so the average price point of a game was?
I wanted to make it $2 when I started. And the first board games we did were $5. And they wound up being in little boxes for $7.50. We did card games for as high as like 15. That's about as high as it went.
And most of it was black and white, except a little bit later you did some color card stuff.
I did some color stuff because at Origins, about 3 years after I started, about 3 years after I started the brand, there were like, you know, 36 games, and they all looked exactly the same. So I did some color games just to kind of break it up.
Right. Any cheap ass games? Thoughts, feelings, Richard?
Well, I think. I certainly don't know all 100 games, but James from the start has been very fast and very varied in his game design, and so each one was a lot of fun to explore. They involved a really wide range of mechanics, including was Falling your first of the real time?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I mean that was really innovative, but this is something which was apparent early on. I actually don't think that he had trouble selling to Wizards because he was unknown, but because Wizards was in those days wrestling with Magic and with licensed products, share some qualities with James. I like to do games and liked to do a lot of them, and I had a lot of trouble getting my games through because of the way Wizards was wrestling with these things.
Right, and I don't think it's an indictment of Wizards specifically. Like, I was in the business long enough to realize that a big publisher has a lot of weight to carry, you know, and I, these games weren't necessarily that good. They were just, let me experiment, let me get this out and see which ones are good. So
yeah,
doing them through CheapS was just a good way to get them out.
I mean, Richard probably had more games rejected by Wizards than you did. And
yeah, that's because after I submitted one, and I stopped.
But yours games, even those in the old days, I mean, it's like CheapS was a really good outlet for them in that even if they weren't good, they were you easily get your money's worth. And it was fun to explore.
Yeah, that was part of the hook, was, oh, come on, it was $5. You know, try it, see if it was any good.
You mean you play a lot of European games, and
I have some of those, yes. Those European games are quite expensive.
Oftentimes, they're very expensive, and oftentimes, they're a lot of fun for, you know, for a few times also.
Well, in 96, when CheapS was kind of invented, there was an arms race in the gaming industry to, I think, make more and more expensive games. All the RPGs wanted to look as good as D&D, all the card games wanted to look as good as Magic. I think Lunch Money came out that year with a price point of $17 for two decks of cards, and people just rolled their eyes. And so I thought there was a gap at that moment, under $10, that nobody was really shooting at. It was a good time to do what I did.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's really nice to pay for the game design. You know, that's essentially what you were doing with those products. You like games, you pay for the games, you get a set of game rules, and you're not paying for 3 pounds of wood.
Right. And, you know, Button Man was a weird exception to that, because here's two character buttons for $4.50 that have five numbers on them. You could download those numbers off the web and just play the game if you wanted to. And a lot of people did, but we sold a lot of Button Man.
Go into a little bit more about the mechanical aspects of Button Man.
Button Man, well, the history is interesting. I had a client who wanted games that would fit on business cards or coasters or whatever, and he wanted these games where the rules would fit on these things, and so I wrote him some of those, but then I thought, that's not really what you want. You want a game where the character is the coaster, and once you know the rules, you don't need them anymore. And I showed him the prototype of Button Man. It's a character with five numbers on it that represent different sizes of dice, and if you have a character and I have a character, we can roll those dice and fight, and the coasters are kind of irrelevant, but they tell you what dice you get. And he wasn't interested in that, so I figured out how to publish it myself as Buttons, and that's how I got the name Button Man, which is, you know, a good name for it, because the characters are all mafia guys in the original set anyway. It's quick playing dice game. It's highly strategic considering that it's a dice game, and because you use a badge to represent the character, people would wear them to conventions and advertise that they played the game, and they turned into good advertising vehicles for a lot of companies.
And so you mentioned it was going to be an iPhone soon?
Yeah, Button Man is coming out for iPhone probably before this airs. I don't know when this will, but we're trying to get an alpha in the cloud by early September.
Usually we are right on it with these podcasts. They come out very quickly. And by the way, everybody, happy Easter. So you mentioned something quickly about the name, Button Man the name. And we had a conversation, James, you and I recently, about the literary aspect of the games that you make and how they're, you more or less, maybe you don't start with a title, but certainly the high concept and your immediate reaction to the name is really important.
Yeah, I have very good luck when I start with a title. Richard mentioned Falling. That's a game that started with a title. Like, I actually imagined a magazine ad for this product that I never actually made, but it was just a sign that said Falling Rocks, you know, on a road somewhere in the mountains, and someone had fallen past it and spray painted an exclamation point after rocks. And like, okay, that's the game, Falling Rocks. And from that was, okay, I have a game called Falling, what's that about? It's about a bunch of people falling. Why are they falling? Who cares? They're falling. And the object is, I don't know, to hit the ground last. I had seen one real-time game. I'd seen Ice House by Andy Looney, which is a game with no turns. Everyone's playing at their own pace. But that's a fairly slow game. And I said, let's do a real-time game that's fast. It's a lot like blackjack in that there's a dealer who's giving cards to everyone, and then those cards get replayed as instructions to the dealer, so you get more cards or less cards, and you try to not hit the ground cards that are at the bottom of the deck. And that's, there you go, that's the whole development process for that game.
But so I just think it's an interesting point of process that you start where you start, because at least in me as a game designer, I usually start with who's it for, what emotional beats am I trying to get across, if it's a licensed product or, you know, a set of mechanical things, and the name comes later. Whereas it's with Cheapass, you turn out a lot of games, and they had a very literary sensibility to them, and you definitely built a brand. And James Ernest and Cheapass are synonymous with that brand. And there's a lot of things that brand means.
For the Cheapass games, we knew our audience. Like, that was kind of established with the brand identity. We're shooting for grown-ups who go to game stores who want to think they're getting away with something. So that's kind of a given. The name helps me think of the mechanics. And the name is also the first thing the player's going to hear about this game. It ought to stick. I've been in lots of meetings then, now, where you have a great game idea, but you don't know what it's about, or you don't know what to call it. And thinking of what to call it is like pulling teeth. It's impossible. I hate those meetings. And I'd rather sit around and come up with a good name and then write the game that goes behind it. Because for me, the game's actually easier than the name.
Yeah, that's my dad tells me this story of, I guess he worked for Seal Test Ice Cream back in the 60s, is one of his first jobs, and they would sit around in a group and think of names of ice cream flavors, and then once they came up with good ones, then they would turn it over to the people that were actually supposed to come up with what the flavors in that flavor were.
And that's a good parallel with Cheapass, too, because like the whole point was, I can't make money on one $5 game. I have to have a dozen. I have to do one every month, which I did for several years, right? And so they need to have the names.
And we've all been in the meetings where it's marketing's responsibility to come up with the packaging, and marketing's responsibility to come up with the logo, right? And in some instances, marketing even taking care of the name and those kinds of things. So it's just an interesting way to approach game design. It's a very personal way, because you were able to self-publish, I've always found it, when working with you, a really interesting part of your process.
And I typically come up with names that don't really need to go through a trademark search, like Captain Park's Imaginary Polar Expedition. I don't really think that there's enough.
I seem to recall a trademark issue you might have had with one of your games.
Oh, I've had one or two. But there's always exceptions. They prove the rule, right?
You do as many games as he has.
I got a really good deal from MGM. I'm not even allowed to talk about it.
Yeah, I bet. We should illuminate the listeners in case they're confused.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Well, product number two after Kill Dr. Lucky was Before I Kill You, Mr. Bond, which was a game about spies. And honestly, like, I was just young.
Never occurred to you.
My company was young and stupid. Of course it occurred to me, right? I'm not surprised, right? I said, if they send me a cease and desist letter, I'll cease and desist. I'll take it out of print. It's not a big deal. So, like, 7 years later, they finally did. And I was like, okay, I'm working with a lawyer right now. Anyway, let me ask him about this. He says, yeah, you should probably quit. But it's a parody. He says, yeah, sure it is. How much have you made on this game? This much? Okay, it's going to cost you twice that much to win. You will win. You ready to go? I'm like, all right, we'll give up. So we ceased and desisted, and as an afterthought, they made me pay $400 in damages. I sold out the game that I had just recently reprinted 3,000 copies in about a month, because everyone knew it was gone and never coming back.
Right.
And then we got to hold a contest to retitle the game, and then we brought it out again in color under a different name.
And the name was?
James Ernest Totally Renamed Spy Game, which is funny now because Mayfair just did a game called Martin Wallace's Totally Renamed Train Game, because they had almost the same problem.
Ah, so it's a little thing.
It's a little thing.
So what we should do
is... anybody in the business who has a trademark issue should just use that meme now.
What I'm thinking is
James
Richard...
Bond's name in a train game.
Mayfair aren't as smart as bulbs in the box.
I think it's Richard Garfield's Totally Renamed Trading Card Game is what we should shoot for with a particular TCG you might have designed.
Skip the licensing problem and go straight with that.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. So,
I have a question.
Let's do it, Richard.
What was your penetration into the European market? Oh, yeah.
Her name was Olga.
I'm asking because...
Why are they laughing?
Because I had a guest from Germany at one point, and I know that when he arrived, one of the things he was very excited about was, he said, I'm going to buy all of the Cheapass games. And he was very excited about that. So was that a problem getting into Europe?
Because I know really. We had some distribution in Europe, but we had a little distribution everywhere, and I'm sure that it was easier to find us on the web than in a game store. One of the nice things about Cheapass Games was we always tried to look smaller than we were, so if you were a fan, you thought you were the only one who was. We got away with that for longer than we should have. But I think in Germany, certainly, they had trouble buying. We did a few of them, we translated a few of them, including the German edition of Kill Dr. Lucky, which is called Kill Dr. Lucky. but Dr. NK in it. And the reason for that, I believe, is was explained to me was the Germans don't have a very good word for kill. I don't know where that
I think it's like the Eskimos in snow.
That's what I thought. They should have hundreds of words for kill, but they all sound like work. So he calls it Kill Dr. Lucky, and that's the German. Meanwhile, the German version of Give Me the Brain, my friend Falco retranslated it, Voice Dusky Hair, and retranslated that title back to me. He said, it's not exactly hilarious. It kind of translates as, excuse me, sir, could you please direct me to the cranium? So there were people at us in the year that those games came out saying, I want to get Give Me the Brain in English because the German version isn't funny.
Yeah, who'd have thunk it? Have you been to Essen?
Yeah.
How many times?
Twice.
Twice? What were your impressions of that?
Well, the first time was awesome because it was totally new. And then I went again the next year and it was 80% the same stuff. So I thought, I'll wait a few years and go back. But it's great. My favorite part is that I learned the Germans follow rules. Because there's a big open door in the back of the exhibit hall that just says, don't come this way. And nobody goes in that way. There's a whole line around the front door. And the back door says, don't come this way.
Yeah, try that at PAX. We'll see how far that goes.
No, I think they have guards or at least locks.
Enforcers. So so now, some people, there hasn't been a cheap ass game in a while. Mr. Ernest?
3 years.
Would you like to speak to that? What happened? Did you...
I got a job.
Juggling again?
Yeah, I now...
I'm a professional game designer.
I'm now a professional juggler. I'm the MV Regent Star, which is currently docked on a sandbar in the Atlantic Ocean. I got a job at Microsoft. A friend of mine worked at Carbonated Games, which is a casual game studio at Microsoft, and he said, you should come and interview for this job. So I've been doing that.
And what did you do while you were at Carbonated?
Oh, I'd rather not say. I don't really feel involved in a project unless it's mine from start to finish.
And how's that working out?
Well, I don't work there anymore.
I see.
No, I work at the Amazing Society now, which is a smaller game company in Issaquah.
And can you talk about your projects or no? You
don't we are doing the Marvel Superhero Squad MMO, which is coming out like next year.
All right,
cool.
And you ever get the itch to...
No, unfortunately. I wish I did. I have done a few game projects, the biggest of which was I took an older game called Dust and Sin, which is about building Las Vegas, and retooled it earlier this year, spent another 6 months on it because it just didn't feel done, and sold it to Mayfair. And they're not going to call it that. They're going to call it some Las Vegas or casino. I don't know what it's called yet, but...
James Ernest's totally renamed board game.
I hope it's James Ernest's totally renamed game about Las Vegas. Yeah, that would be cool.
Published by Mayfair.
Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. So, what would you tell a lot of the people who listen to our podcast? They both want to know, what would you tell people who are trying to get into game design? You, sir, forged your own path after Wizards. What would you tell? What's the top three things you would say to a burgeoning tabletop game designer?
Leave me alone, I won't buy your game. No, seriously, the door's that way. And don't make me call the police.
All right.
Yeah, that'll help you.
Fantastic.
I don't really know. I mean, you're right, I published my... I did my own thing, and I had done publishing before. I published a juggling book and had a business license and all of that already set up. When I started, I kind of knew all the ins and outs of self-publishing. So if you know that, if you want to run a business, start a business. If you want to make games, take a different course than I did.
Right. And do you see any parallels between the small, like, casual flash game market and the cheap ass?
Yeah, a lot. In fact, hopefully, I've got a friend who wants to start making some of my games for the iPhone. Not just Buttonman, but a whole bunch of the old black and white stuff.
Right. And Kill Dr. Lucky is on Game Table Online?
Yeah, it's been there for quite a long time. I don't think that they get a lot of traffic there, but it's up and playable.
Yeah. Any other transliterations? I mean, I guess you're saying some iPhone stuff. Do you play... What games do you play, Mr. Ernest?
I play the Xbox. I like some easy Xbox. I play Rock Band a lot. I play poker a lot. And I dabble in all the hobby games just to see what's out there.
Yeah. Anything caught your eye? Have you played Dominion or Agricola or any of those games?
I have. We just got the new piece. There's an aftermarket piece pack for Agricola that's like people-shaped people and cow-shaped cows, and they're adorable. So my 7-year-old daughter and I played Agricola again this week. Had a good, fun time. And yeah, I play a lot of Dominion.
And the rumor has it that you're actually you are also, in addition to being James Ernest, you have another persona in the form of a webcomic. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. I have a webcomic that I've been writing for about a year with a friend of mine, Brian Murphy, called Brian and John.
And where might we find this?
You might find it at brianandjohn.com.
But we also might not.
Oh, you will.
Oh.
A new comic every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
That's pretty pro. That's a lot of comics.
It's 3 weeks.
Is it the cheap-ass games of online webcomics?
No, they're all the cheap-ass games of webcomics, I think. This one's just, you know, a couple of guys. We're funny.
Do you do the art or just John?
Brian's the artist and I'm the writer.
But wait a minute. So, if Brian's the artist, who's John?
I am John.
Now I'm confused.
Well, typically when you start a webcomic, you make up a name.
Is that what it is?
That's how it works.
All right, fair enough. All right. Do you guys have any closing thoughts about... self-publishing, cheap-ass games in general?
Sure. I will give advice to people out there who are listening.
I was specifically not asking you.
Well, I will tell you. Okay. Whether you're asking or not, you who are listening, who are thinking about self-publishing a game, are not as smart or hardworking as James is, so don't do it.
Fair. That's a very good point.
And unless it's really like a pure vanity project. Now, there are some of you, maybe, possibly, who can do it, but it's just a lot of work. So consider trying to get your games published elsewhere first, unless you like to
I usually say don't start a game company unless you like companies more than you like games. Because that's what you're going to do. You're going to spend all your time running your business and wishing you were doing game design.
Yeah, I usually say don't go into game design unless you love the process of designing games, and that means every step of the way, whatever. Whether it's pitching to people, if that's what you've got to do, or playtesting it, or running a company, if that's what you end up doing, you better be enjoying the whole process, because you know, whatever you see as being the golden apple at the end is a really long shot.
That's as entertainers, and that's in part what we are. We make our jobs look easy, and I think anybody can get into game design thinking that designing a game is just fun. But you're right, it's a lot of work, and I have background in graphic design and technical writing and a lot of things that make the thing actually work.
Yeah, that's one of the things, I mean, the three gentlemen I have with me right now represent the cream of the crop in terms of game design that I've ever been personally exposed to, and one of your strengths is definitely that...
hand-eye coordination is
you do have an amazing jack-of-all-trades skill set, and it's not like a normal bard. You have high ranks in all of them, so allow me to compliment you in that way, because we've gone down the road,
including juggling. Let's not forget how important that was
for the bard class,
for the game Huzzah, which is about working at a Ren Faire. My juggling background came in very strong for that game design.
Oh, you do your research, sir.
Yes, sir. I was a juggler for 15 years just so that I could write a game about working at a Ren Faire.
And those, I'm sure it sold like crazy.
If like crazy means locked in a rubber room, then yes, it sold just like that.
Yeah, Kill Dr. Lucky, a crowd favorite. Talk a little bit about the process of making that game.
I knew that I was making some games, and the title came into my head, Kill Dr. Lucky. That was, the first thing that I thought of. It was... The picture in my head was from a short story that I had done in college called The Butler Wore Black, which was just a funny little, you know, Agatha Christie mystery where everyone gets together and somebody gets killed. And in fact, in this one, everyone killed him at the same time. And that has, you know, its basis in Clue and the Clue movie and mystery stories and mystery movies and whatever. So with that as the title, I'm driving across town. I get at my friend's house and I'm like, I'm going to do a game called Kill Dr. Lucky. How does that sound? Okay, good. Go. From there, we said, okay, what are the most important things about killing Dr. Lucky? We talked for a while about getting motive and opportunity, and we eventually abandoned motive and just said, okay, you just want to kill him. Just believe that. We're not going to worry about that as a mechanic. We're just going to tell everyone who's playing that they want to kill him and focus on the opportunity, which is you think you're the only one who wants to kill him, so here's a map of his house. You want to be alone in a room with him. You want to be in a place where nobody can see you. And you want to try to kill him. And he's called Dr. Lucky because we want to try to kill him a lot of times, and we want to fail a lot. So that's where the real game mechanic of the game is. I am going to try to kill Dr. Lucky very often. And his luck is represented by cards that other people can drop to say, no, you failed. That's kind of how it came about. The sight lines and how the board is laid out all kind of developed out of that. And, you know, I knew even with the first game I did for Cheap Ass that we wanted to keep it very simple, very light, very quick to play and easy to learn and all of that.
And just from a development standpoint, the sight lines are a pretty interesting part of that game, something that Roborally shares, right, is the idea that the pieces being able to look at each other.
Right.
No?
Rubber
on?
The pieces
can... You shoot other pieces.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And okay. So if the pieces can see each other, then they destroy each other.
Right, they have lasers that fire off orthogonally. Right. And I had played Rubber Rally, and I pretty much made sure that Kill Dr. Lucky worked the same way.
I was just noting there were similarities.
Yeah, I hear you loud and clear, Tyler. Oh, it's all a lie. I just stole everything I did from Richard Garfield.
So talk a little bit about the process so you kind of went up through the design. Talk about your process of playtesting or development, or like how you refine the game and tune it to the point where you feel like it's ready to go.
Well, I try to get it in front of playtesters as quickly as possible and get multiple heads looking at the problem, and everyone's going to have a different point of view and a different set of expectations. And it's nice, even sometimes with blank cards, to get people in a room and say, this is the game you're playing, this is what you're supposed to do, what do you expect will happen next? You get a lot of good feedback from that. People bring entirely different sets of experience and expectations to a playtest, and Kill Dr. Lucky was one of those. Like I said, one designer spent a lot of time saying there should be motive cards in this, and you should have to accumulate them before you can succeed, and that just turned out to be one more axis of difficulty that we can take out.
Yeah.
So how long? So you brought the people in. You brought playtesters in relatively early.
Like yeah.
You had a. And then from the time that you first brought in playtesters to the final, say, you know, beta version or the final product, did it change?
Which for CheapAss was the same thing.
Did it change a huge amount? Or
That particular one, not really. Partially because a lot of the stuff, the early design work was done in a brainstorming session. Like, when I do a game design just cold with nobody watching and I write down a whole bunch of rules and this is how it's going to work, it does not survive first contact with the playtesters. But with the, it's kind of the same group in the room, it feels more similar, I think, in the final than that. We probably were testing that, it's 10 years ago or longer, but we were probably testing that game for about 4 months between concept and execution.
And then how many, you know, I mean, obviously it's a long time ago, but how many playtesters did you have? Like, was it one group?
I had a regular group of about a dozen people, and about 6 to 8 of them were there on a given night. So, and it was a mix. There were some really hardcore game players who wanted to break the game, and they were very important. You know, my friend Jeff can tell me that Kill Dr. Lucky is broken for 8 players because 7 players can conspire to keep the 8th from ever winning. But there are also people who I try to keep as casual as possible who just are happy to say, this isn't fun. I'm not going to work at it. I'm not going to buy into your idea that this game is good. Just entertain me or I'm out of here. Those are really important people to have.
And do you play test with people that were cold, or were they all more or less like a group of friends and pretty consistent? How big was your playtest pool?
My internal group was a group of friends, and they really were taught how to test, right? I mean, some of them were being like childish, entertain me or I'm gone, but like that was their job, and they knew that. And what that means is the group is perfectly happy to stop a game in the middle, change a rule, start over. They don't care who wins. They will play open-handed. Because if you play open-handed, you can get leaps and bounds ahead of the game and say, well, this is what strategic smart people would be doing in a game where you might change the rules tomorrow. You don't want to play it until everyone's really good at it. Just everybody play your hand face up and say, this is why I'm doing this.
So you simulated having smart friends.
Yeah. Well, more importantly, simulating having experience, people who are experienced playing the game in front of them.
Yeah, that's really interesting because there is a sort of minimum required good decision-making that you have to have in playtesting.
Yeah, or else you can always test the first experience. We never did really enough of that, frankly. But to test the 10th experience of the game is either you have to play it 10 times and really be focused, or you can cheat.
Did you find over time your playtest time went down or up, or it just became more effective?
It just really varies from game to game. Sometimes ideas just would not work, and we had a game called U.S. Patent Number 1, where the story, I stuck to the story from the beginning, was everyone has invented a time machine at a different period in history, and you're all racing to the day the patent office opens to try to be the guy that owns the patent on time travel. So, you know, it's basically just a racing game with that fun idea, and we built four completely from the ground up versions of that game, because the first three were terrible, and the last one is the one we printed, which may or may not also be terrible. So that game took way longer than it should have to get the one that was good. Some games, let's see, my record for designing from concept to production is 3 hours.
Whoa.
That's the short end.
Okay. I was confused for a second.
And the long end is like 8 years. The Dice Land was the original concept for Dice Land, which is very, very different from the final product, was invented at a con in late 96, and it came out 8 years after that.
Well, talk a little bit about Dice Land. What was the, when you say there was a different original concept?
I had a friend.
The one with the collapsible?
The paper dice, yeah. They're not supposed to be collapsible, but when you sit on them, they become collapsible. I actually tried to engineer a collapsing paper dice so that they'd be easier to transport, but it was not going to work. The inception of this is a broken record. I've had this story happen a lot. This guy comes to me and says, "Hey, I want you to design a game for me." "Okay, what kind of game do you want?" "Well, I want a game you could play in a bar." And I thought about that. I said, "All right, you can play it in a bar. So it's going to be portable, it's going to be waterproof, it's going to be quick. How about a dice game? How about a custom dice game? You could make money selling custom dice." So I wrote on this custom dice game called Zodiac. 2 weeks later, I say, "What about this?" He says, "Oh, I see. Yeah, no, I guess when I said a game you could play in a bar, I guess what I meant was a game about owning a bar. Everybody wants to own a bar. I mean, I want to own a bar. In fact, I think what I really want is to own a bar. Bye." So, like, bam, it's gone, and now here's this game design of custom dice, which I cannot produce. I don't have the money to produce custom dice, right?
Right.
So I got a game on my shelf. You can play it in a bar, but I can't produce this thing. So that was the beginning of that game, and it was 3 8-sided dice with different numbers on them, and where they landed was important, which direction they were pointing was important, and they would shoot each other and capture each other in this particular way. So it required the skill of throwing them
into
play.
So like a Roborally kind of thing.
It was very much like Roborally, yeah. We were talking about that before, and I'm just revealing who I am. So eventually this game of Zodiac partially turned into Button Men, where, you know, here's some custom characters where the dice are the same, but more of the design principles went into eventually into Dice Land. It was called Super 8s for a while because they were 8-sided dice. We had the idea to make them into paper when someone came to me and said, "I want a game that I could put in a Happy Meal." And I thought, well, what's even cheaper than putting it in the Happy Meal is die cutting it out of the box. So now I realize, okay, if I can print on cardboard dice, I can get a lot more detail than I can with just custom molded dice. Let's look into that. And of course, that client fell through again. So I'm like, well, maybe I can die cut these myself. And that was the Dice Land, sort of the beginning of the end of Dice Land. And it was still 3 years between, okay, let's make paper dice, to this is the miniatures game called Dice Land that I can actually, you know, feel good about.
And you did one expansion, Great White North? No, there was Space.
Deep White Sea was the original set.
Right.
We did about 4 expansions for Dice Land, despite the fact that it didn't sell very well, because I just loved it. And the people who liked it really, really liked it.
Yeah.
But there weren't enough people. It's got barriers. It requires throwing skill, so that's off-putting for people. It has randomness in it, so people who play miniatures games do not want to hear about it. And you might crush it when you sit on it. So that kind of was the death knell for Dice Land.
And we worked on a game where you tossed chips on a table, but we never worked on a Dice Land expansion. Is that right? Is my memory correct?
I don't know if you were involved in Space or not.
I think Falco
was working on Space.
But just as an aside, I think simultaneous while we were designing an expansion for Clout, Scaff was running a team or on a team designing an expansion for Clout.
I did.
As well.
Yeah, also designed.
And Richard, were you was involved in that?
No, it was me and Jim.
Yeah, and neither of those expansions came out, just because maybe this is a good note for any game designers out there. The lion's share of what you make doesn't come out unless you are cheap-ass
printing it yourself.
Right?
Yeah. So you're the designer on every cheap-ass game, correct?
With two exceptions, yes.
Okay.
Starbase Jeff was done by my friend Jim Geldmacher, which people thought was a pseudonym for me, and I'm like, why would I need a pseudonym?
Yeah, far be it for you to have multiple names.
Well, I do have a pseudonym, but Jim Geldmacher certainly wasn't one. I assisted in the final design of Starbase Jeff, but that's a little tile-laying game. It's a little gambling game, and it's very, very nice. And then Tom Jolly sold me a game called Lightspeed. And Tom comes up to me all the time and says, oh, I really, really like all your cheap-ass games, especially that Starbase Jeff. I'm like, yes, thank you for reminding me that that's the one I didn't make. And more than one fan has come up to me and said, I really, really like cheap-ass games, especially Lightspeed. And also Starbase Jeff. Like, there is that guy who likes the Tom Jolly game and the Jim McGeldmacher game and basically nothing else.
So, and then of the other ones, were you the sole designer? How many, like,
there,
do you
many of them
on
have a
team?
Co-design credit. So, like, Paul Peterson is co-designer on Exploded Cow. Falco Getch is on a co-designer on U.S. Patent Number 1. Rick Fish is co-designer on Kill Dr. Lucky. A lot of people have kind of been a contributor of that stature that they get their name in the credits. But, yeah, I'm kind of the lead on everything else.
Oh, I had a question. You said that the cheap ass did around 100 games, but then you said there were 50 mini games or sets of games.
So over the course of the cheap ass history, we did a lot of free games. We did them on business cards and in ads, in magazine pages, and so on. We collected those into two collections called Chief Herman's Holiday Fun Pack and Chief Herman's Next Big Thing, and each one of those has about 25 of those games in it.
Okay, I remember seeing a few of those.
Yeah, and they're really small and light, but they're—I mean, you know—rule for dollar, those are the best collections out there.
I remember seeing a couple of them. They were really interesting. They could have been certainly would have expected to see it in Scientific America or something because they were.
Well, and some of them are like from. They're very, very similar to games that I sold all the rights to magazines, and most of them I had all the rights to and just published as they were, but. A lot of them may be the first ones that we do for the iPhone because they're very simple and lightweight and good for that platform.
Do you know if there's still cheap-ass games in distribution, if somebody goes to the retail store anymore? I know I see them periodically.
I feel terrible when I go to a retail store because I see, like, one bedraggled copy of One False Step Home, which is an expansion to One False Step for Mankind, which nobody's ever going to want, and one beat-up copy of More Cards for the Big Idea, and basically, unfortunately, no. Most of the cheap-ass games are out of stock. Paizo has the remainder of our warehouse, so you can order it from paizo.com, but the number of titles that are still around is not many, and of course, it's the ones that aren't, to be honest, not that good, right? The really, really good ones are gone.
So they're collectible now.
They are. In fact, the ones that are left are really, really.
But the
best titles, it's not because I took them out of print, but because I found better homes for them. So Steve Jackson has Lord of the Fries now, and Paizo has Kill Dr. Lucky, and a few other titles that are out there being published by people who are still in the business.
Because Scaff just mentioned so. Reprinting titles not on the horizon for cheap ass?
No, it was time for us to sell our inventory down and make some of our money back. Some of our most profitable years, all that money was in the warehouse. And it's really frustrating to say, look, your bottom line's gorgeous. It's all stacked up in your garage.
Right.
So when I got the job in the real world, we said, let's just sell down the inventory. Let's don't bother ourselves with reprints. The best-selling title, Kill Dr. Lucky, we took deliberately out of print because Paizo had the color edition. And everything else was kind of like, you know, we made our money on this. If it's gone, we win, right?
Yeah. And did you do a game for Stonehenge?
Yeah, Stonehenge was actually an original concept that I did, that I first pitched to Wizards when Paul Randles was working in Board Games at Wizards.
Right. And Richard, do you have a design in Stonehenge as well?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So we got 2/5 of the Stonehenge crew here, right?
And so the base concept was yours, right? Because it's very cheap-ass gaming, right?
Yeah, it was. It was a sort of another way to deliver cheap-ass games. Stonehenge is they call it an anthology board game. Is that what
yeah,
they call it?
Yeah, that's what they call
where
it.
They take the same set of pieces and give it to 5 different designers. And the idea was you put all 5 of those designers on the box, and you say, oh, these guys are all great, and they all did a game in this box. Here's 5 games for the price of one. And Stonehenge is that. It's, for better or worse, it is... Five designers splitting the amount that one designer would get paid for one board game.
And who designed the pieces?
It was collaboration, I think.
The content of the piece pack was definitely collaborative. We started with a pretty big set of generic pieces and pared it down to what the first 5 guys really wanted to use. As far as the form factor of the pieces, I don't really know. I think it was production at Paizo.
And I could take this part out if I'm wrong, but did you have a game in the book Rules of Play? The Salen Zimmerman book?
Yes.
Because I know, and...
two textbooks came out the same year, so I don't remember which one is Rules of Play.
They run together for me,
they
too.
They do, yeah.
Yeah, because I know Richard is in Rules of Play.
One of those books had a case study, and I did a game called Caribbean Star.
I think that's Rules of Play.
Yeah, I actually wrote that one while on a cruise ship with my wife in the summer of 2000.
Right. And Richard, you have a game in Rules of Play, I'm pretty sure, because I think I just recently read it.
Sibling rivalry.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you guys have been co-published at least twice together.
That's yeah.
You're basically blood brothers at this point. speaking of books, you also have a couple of poker books, no?
Yeah, I have written 5/6 of a poker book. That is, I wrote half of one and a third of another.
Well, what are those books?
One of them is called The Art of Texas Hold'em, which was originally published by Eagle Games. And it's, with Mike Selinker, a pretty straightforward introduction to how to play Texas Hold'em. It was originally commissioned to be a companion to the software product that they were releasing. So it's not like there aren't a million Hold'em books in the world, but we did another one. And the other one's called Dealer's Choice, which is Mike Selinker, myself, and Phil Folio. And Phil Folio has been collecting crazy Dealer's Choice Friday night poker game variants for possibly longer than I've been alive, and has always wanted to do a poker book. So this was his chance, with the two of us, to actually get it in print.
And Phil did illustrations as well as
Phil illustrated it and had the original collection of games that it's based on. And it's more than 200, like, crazy... Some of them we invented, many of them are traditional.
Can you give me one off the top of your head, an interesting one for the kids listening?
So my favorite one, this is an invention of my friend Jordan, it's called Frankenstein, and it's 5-card draw, but the winner has to beat the monster hand, and that's made of all the discards that everyone's thrown away. And if the winner doesn't beat the monster, then he matches the pot and everyone plays again, or everyone who hasn't folded. What that means is that if there's 6 players, let's say, it's going to be hard to beat the monster, so everyone throws really good cards away, and they actually try to get a small hand, a bad hand, and like the pair of sixes that turns out to be the best hand matches the pot. And so, all right, fine. He's either smart and he folds before that happens, or he matches the pot and he sticks around, holds onto it like a bull terrier. And as people fold, the monster gets weaker and weaker, and eventually somebody says, you know, I think I can go for the high hand now. But by now the pot's already like $40, right? And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it's a really intricate, difficult multi-hand game just from that one rule that you have to beat the monster.
That's awesome. And I know you're a Vegas frequenter. I've played poker with you at least once in Vegas in a high roller suite, as I recall. And how often do you get down there?
I get down to Vegas about 6 times a year.
Yeah.
I love it down there. Usually I have some work-related reason to go, but I'm there all the time, mostly to play poker or slot machines. I'm a terrible, terrible gambler.
Yeah, I don't think that's entirely true. But
no, but honestly, the reason that I give everyone that I play slot machines is because I design slot machines. Part of what I do is write casino games and try to get a foot in the door in that industry.
I seem to recall we had a meeting.
We did
once trying to sell a couple of card games.
We pitched a couple of card games.
Yeah.
We did in fact.
So talk about your love for poker. What is it that gets you going?
I just like to, you know, hurt people. I played poker since I was 5. My grandmother taught me how to play 5-card draw, and it's wonderfully simple, and everybody knows it, and it's more exciting because there's money involved, and there's a head game that's going on for your whole life. You're playing the same game. I think it's the best game ever.
I like the fact that it's got there's the math logic piece and there's a psychology piece, and they're constantly commingling, and it's a really compelling set of things. Richard, you play a little poker?
I love poker. It is probably, if I had to pick one game, that would probably be it as well.
If you were on a desert island?
Would it have to be poker, or could it be like a deck of cards?
One game. Right. When you ask Mike Selinker this question, I will steal this joke from him, but I'll give him credit.
I'd probably pick some sort of single-player game.
Yeah, he says I will have the build-a-boat game.
So, Richard, what did you talk about poker?
He's a good game.
I like it very much, this poker.
Poker's terrific. It is as James said, so universally known and simple, and it's got so many different levels. It's also, I mean, it plays so quickly, and if so, it can fit into any schedule. You can play a few hands. You can play a tournament, and then one of the things that brought me back for a long time was just how many varieties there were. I was totally in this camp of players who liked the wacky games, and invented wacky games.
Any wacky game you can share with us?
Well, sure. One which I don't particularly recommend to play more than once or twice, but I liked it. It came to mind because James mentioned the Frankenstein game. I had one called Zombie Poker, and with Zombie Poker, it was seven card stud, and if you folded, you still kept on getting cards, and if you got dealt a spade, you came back into the game because you were dug up.
Right. And that's in our book as Night of the Living Dead, and it has variants Night Baseball of the Living Dead.
that was a fun game to play a couple times, but it wasn't really fun once you sort of knew how to play it.
Yeah, I think they did that in the World Series 2004, but then it didn't.
There's also Len Casey has a book called Night Baseball of the Living Dead for expert players, which I have dog-eared.
And I'm pretty sure I'm the terrier player profile in that one.
Yeah, that's right. He describes your player type as the bitch.
Well, another awful game is Second Best Poker. You're supposed to get the second best hand.
Yeah, we call that Bob Dole. That'll tell you how long ago we named it. But yeah, trying to get the second best hand turns out to be the worst game mechanic I've ever seen.
That's probably the worst one I ever played.
I mean, it's good because it's simple, but actually playing that game is, you have nothing to grab hold of.
No, it's awful. One of the things about poker which really intrigues me is that what brought me into it was this incredible variety. But you also get such pleasure from mastering something like Texas Hold'em being universal. I'm conflicted about that because I love having this universal game which everybody has this basis of expertise in, which allows you to play a much more exciting game. But I'm conflicted about it because it takes people away from this thing where you can play, you know, whatever strange, wacky variant you want to play.
When I do design lectures, I talk about something called the tweak and try cycle, which is a period from kind of a cold start where you, as a game player, can try a new strategy and see what it does, and then get back to a cold start. And in a game like, I don't know, tic-tac-toe, right, there's no randomness, this is a bad example, but you can try several different openings and see what that does very quickly. So that has a very short tweak and try cycle. In a game like Dominion, maybe it's medium-sized, and the cards change all the time. In a game like Agricola, which is like a 2-3 hour game, if you try some weird strategy, you're kind of stuck with it for 3 hours. Poker has this neat thing that every hand is only a couple of minutes, but you're not going to get the same hand every time, or you'd be in the same position. So your tweak and try cycles are a whole bunch of different little opportunities. How am I going to play aces from early position? Well, I only get that chance every few hours. But how am I going to play from early position? I can try that every few hands. How am I going to play against this guy? I can try that every hand. And that's an addictive sort of random reinforcement schedule that keeps you in the game, and part of what makes it fascinating over time.
Excellent. Scott, any poker stories?
No, just the poker can be expensive to dally in the tweak and try cycle too much.
And that's where I am. On that note, let's play.
Yeah. On that note, I think we'll wrap this thing up and get out the card table. On behalf of Scaffolize,
Goodbye.
Richard Garfield.
Till next time.
And our guest, James Ernest.
Hello, I mean goodbye.
And I'm Tyler Bielman. Thanks for tuning in to the Games with Garfield podcast.
Thank you for calling Houston's Mission Control Technical Support Hotline. Para Espanol, Marte Ocho.